welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and today is day two of the Assumption Act. And actually, this is where we get to the meat of the Assumption Act. Now, as I was mentioning yesterday, and I really want to throw my thanks again out to Eric for joining us for, you know, kicking off the curriculum of the shenanigans of players in the federal government. Now, there's a lot of people out there that try to get you to believe that the government itself, the Constitution, and the constitutional government that was formed based on the Constitution is the problem. That is not true at all, folks. It is incumbent for us to look at what our government really is. So our government is the Constitution. It is the edifices, the buildings that it has created to operate. And then there are the players who are the operators. Those are our public servants, the bureaucrats, and so forth. Are there constitutional bureaucrats? Absolutely. Is the State Department a legitimate role? Absolutely. It's a legitimate responsibility. Do they need all those people? No. Because as government has grown its scope and so forth, they have had to create players to maintain and manage and control those things that government has done in the State Department and so forth. So when you start looking at the Treasury and you start looking at the State Department and the War Department, they have aggrandized themselves accordingly as government has taken on new roles, responsibilities, powers, and property. And we can drill into that. And, you know, one day we will, when we actually start going into the outlays and what has been created. Because if you actually look at the outlays, the budget, and if you can even go to probably Wikipedia, but I would recommend going to the U.S. government itself and look at all of the government entities from A to Z. Because you can actually go and look at this. It's available to you. And so when you look under the State Department, you will see a whole bunch of sub-entities underneath the State Department. And many of them are tied to roles and responsibilities of the federal government that, you know, such as the treaties that we've created, like an interface to the UN. Well, that's unconstitutional that we've created a treaty with the UN. We even have a petition on that. And the fact of the matter is, as they've created these unconstitutional associations and links and so forth in the State Department, then they've actually created offices and sub-agencies and so forth within the State Department to interface with these unconstitutional associations, treaties, what have you. The same thing with the Department of Defense and the same thing with the Department of Treasury. So just want to help you understand that the magnitude of the problem is, you know, very immense, but the ease of getting it all back into the box of the Constitution is very, very easy. If you've ever looked at or if you've ever watched an audit of a compact happen, it's very, it's really quick. I will say it's fast and clean. You know, when you start identifying what the problems are, boom, they just literally fall into the bucket. These can't exist. And when you create that bucket, then it just becomes automatic of what has to be done. They have to be dismantled. Now, the process actually may take time. And the reason it takes time is there's people involved. You just have to understand that because there's people involved, we just don't turn the lights off right now. Not that D.C. doesn't deserve to have, you know, this level of blight and problems. Not that they don't deserve it. It's the people that don't deserve it. If you've ever been on the end of a plank where you've had to walk because your employer says, we don't need you anymore, we're laying you off, that's not a good feeling, folks. And as a matter of fact, coming to the knowledge, you know, that you've got a job, you believe that this job is legitimate, then all of a sudden the reality sets in that you're actually being paid to do something, and you're supposedly thinking that you're earning a retirement that is illegitimate, that it has become a leech or a sucking chest wound that has been bleeding and destroying. Now, 9 times out of 10, when it comes to a person and their own personal needs, 9 times out of 10, they will put their personal needs ahead of what is best for the nation, which is why when we look at what will happen to D.C., many of these people will try to fight this. I mean, the courts will be, they will try to overrun the courts, but by this point in time, the courts' doors will be shut as far as any jurisdiction. So one of the things that we're doing regarding this, these petitions and everything else, is kind of centered on, you know, like especially with the courts, we're actually addressing this in the court system, or I should say how the courts have taken on legislation and so forth. And if you look at petition 2 and then petition 8 is the legislative powers, we're actually identifying that the court, you know, they can't even, you know, the states will have to create a basically like a little gate that you can't go into a federal court unless the jurisdiction has been cleared. And I believe the state courts have to be that gate guard. In other words, the gatekeeper, because they're the ones that say, you know what, that's not within the Constitution. You just can't walk over there and knock on that door. And the federal courts will be getting a directive and will actually, if necessary, the states will have to create an amendment to say, you just can't open your doors because somebody's knocking. Because as far as I'm concerned, it is clear in the Constitution that their jurisdiction is limited to only those things arising under this Constitution. And if it's not there, then they can't do it. But I digress. I really need to get into the content that what we need to cover today. And and one of the key things that I think we need to cover first is Jefferson's account on what ended up happening to create the assumption. And then we'll get into the bill that kind of leads to the assumption itself. Now, Jefferson creates this account, and I believe the account was created, you know, because it was in his personal diaries. And this is kind of interesting because, you know, in his personal diaries, he makes some comments regarding Hamilton. And, you know, it's kind of interesting. And the way the words are, as a matter of fact, I'll tell you that there's a lot of Latin in this, so I'm going to struggle. Everybody that knows how, you know, I have this ease of getting tongue-tied. I mean, I've told people, you know, I've always had a problem, or I've always had a fear of public speaking just due to the fact that, you know, when I read something, sometimes it's either dyslexic or what have you, I just don't get it right. And so I'm not that good at that. And, you know, I'm not the only one in the course of history that has been flung or been pushed into a role of responsibility. This is why I tell you folks, you need to go and seek out Toastmasters if you have the same problem I have, because it'll at least get you the level of experience and training of how to dynamically speak and how to be able to have at least the best command of your faculties that you possibly can. Now, I wish I could have done, you know, Toastmasters longer than what the year and a half, 2 years I was involved in it, because I just, it's fun, you know, and that the person, if you've ever watched a Toastmasters, there's a guy with a little clicker. Every time you say, or, you know, some kind of crutch word, click, click, you know, they click you. And it's almost like when you first start, it's almost like getting hit with a shock. And we call that classical conditioning, if you understand Pavlov's dog and so forth. But anyway, this is Jefferson's account on the bargain made by him, Hamilton, and Madison regarding the assumption and residence bills that came out. Now, this is what it states, and this is his document or his record. The assumption of the state debts in 1791 was a supplementary measure in Hamilton's financial system. Now, I mentioned this yesterday, that Hamilton had designs. This was a supplemental domino. In other words, this was the initial domino that would lay out his plans of how he could create this grand financial system. Anyway, moving back on to what Jefferson stated, he says, when attempted in the House of Representatives, it failed. In other words, Madison won the day. This threw Hamilton himself and a number of members into deep dismay. Going to the president's one day, I met Hamilton as I approached the door. His look was somber, haggard, and dejected beyond description. Even his dress, uncouth and neglected. He asked to speak with me. We stood in the street near the door. He opened the subject of the assumption of the state debts and necessity of it in the general fiscal arrangement and its indispensable necessity towards the preservation of the Union. Now, remember, I'm stopping here. Now, remember, the one thing that Hamilton needed was he needed a good excuse to turn the machine on full bore. So what's better than to have all of this debt thrown onto the lap of the federal government, such as the assumption of the state's debt, which wasn't all of the states. I mean, there was all these different violations of this. But as soon as he got this debt, as soon as he got everybody to agree that this debt would then be on the federal government, Hamilton was then free to be able to start, you know, turning on the tax machine and actually getting things moving so that they could go out and aggressively start taxing the states. And so this is where he started really thinking of excise taxes and all different ways that he could come up with. And the whiskey tax was a part of this. So in other words, when you really look at the beginning decade of the federal government, the reason there were so many breaches in the Constitution and so much upheaval and chaos being created all had to do with Hamilton. Now, let me ask you this. Do you believe that the things that we had to go through were important? I will tell you absolutely. I don't believe that Hamilton was doing the work of the Lord. I do not believe that he was exercising those things that were right. But what he did do, and what what Satan had basically convinced him to do, was to take these measures and try to aggrandize the government. And he gave us the cases of what we needed to do and what should have happened. And I'll try to go through that a little bit more in all of this. But anyway, so it's indispensability and necessity towards the preservation of the Union, and particularly of the New England states, who had made great expenditures during the war on expeditions, which, though of their own undertaking, were for the common cause, that they considered the assumption of these debts by the Union so just and its denial so palpably injurious that they would make it a sine qua non of a continuance of the, in other words, they would withdraw and step away from the Union. And I'm stopping here again, because one of the things that history doesn't cover, but those students of history will know, that in the northern states, the New England states, Connecticut actually, when Jefferson was becoming president, Connecticut actually was looking to push a convention of states or absolutely withdrawing from the Union. And they actually had a convention of the northern states to basically consider a withdrawal. And so, you know, the delicacy of the Union was really at stake. And I believe that what Hamilton did and these assumptions and taking us on this wrong course served several purposes, but it did give us a good broad view of what we were supposed to do. Now, what should have happened had the states been noble. But you got to remember that, as I tell you, that the states, many of these states, New York, I wouldn't even have thunk that, you know, Massachusetts, obviously, there was the anti-federalists, and they had a very vigorous debate, and New York had another vigorous debate. And so from New York north, there were all of these states that actually started grumbling, going, maybe we don't like this union that we've got, because their interests were a lot different. They were very close to the crown. This is where the Anglophiles were very prevalent. You got to remember that there was riots. There was actually riots in Pennsylvania and going south, where they wanted to actually declare, when Washington came out with his neutrality of foreign affairs, they actually wanted him to align with France and actually get involved with the French Revolution, which would have been, there's no doubt, it would have been a disaster. It would have been a bigger mess, aligning with the despotism of Napoleon. And it's easy to do armchair quarterbacking, but let me get on to what I was saying here. That as to his, this is Jefferson again, that as to his own part, if he had no credit enough to carry such a measure, that he could not, that he could be of no use, and was determined to resign. Jefferson had pity on the creature. Remember I said yesterday that Madison and Jefferson ended up calling Hamilton the creature. And to me, there's no doubt that this was a manipulative act of Hamilton. He observed at the same time that though our particular business laid in separate departments, yet the administration and its success was a common concern, and that we should make common cause. Boy, is he beguiling him or what? That the common cause in supporting one another. He added his wish that I would interest my friends from the South, who were those most opposed to it. I answered that I had been so far long absent from my country that I had lost familiarity with its affairs. Now, what he just said right here, what he just said right there, was basically my submission that Thomas Jefferson really didn't understand this Constitution. He didn't understand the debates. He wasn't even a part of it. And so, on top of that, he's already admitting that he had been separated and disjointed from the affairs of the southern states, or specifically Virginia, where he, you know, called home. Jefferson goes on and says, and being but lately returned, had not yet got into the train of them, or the train of thought and understanding what they're doing. And he goes on and says, that the fiscal system being out of my department, I had not yet undertaken to consider and understand it, that the assumption had struck me in an unfavorable light, but still not having considered it sufficiently, I had not considered it, or I had not concerned in it, but that I would resolve that what he had urged in my mind was a real fact, that the eastern and southern members, South Carolina, however, was the former, had got into the most extreme ill humor with one another. This broke out on every question with the most alarming heat, the bitterest in animosities, the bitterest, and it says animosities, seemed to be endangered. And though they met every day, little or nothing could be done from mutual distrust and antipathy. On considering the situation of things, I thought the first step towards some conciliation of views would be to bring Mr. Madison and Colonel Hamilton to a friendly discussion on the subject. I immediately wrote to each to come and dine with me the next day, mentioning that we should be alone, that the object was to find some temperament for the present fever, and that I was persuaded that men of sound minds, or sound heads, and honest views needed nothing more than an explanation and mutual understanding to enable them to unite in some measures which might enable us to get along. Now, I'm going to tell you right here that, okay, so I'm exposing something that you're not seeing, because Jefferson's writing this. When you're writing your own journal, 9 times out of 10, you really don't write into it that you have a devious plan. At least a person that has the conscience of understanding that his personal writings may be viewed by the world after his death. If he's actually going to write, commit something to paper, be very cautious of how you can portray yourself. Because had he put what I believe was one of his designs, Jefferson's designs, I believe that it would have boded bad for Jefferson historically. And I say this because, and maybe this is good that I'm doing this by myself, because I know there's a lot of people that, you know, he was a great man. Jefferson was a great man. He had one flaw. He had financial desires greater than his means. He was considered by Adams a spendthrift, and he was one that, you know, just kept on spending. And the reality, the truth of the matter was that Jefferson was always looking to be able to get more money into his own pockets. And Jefferson actually became a speculator, and the whole concept here, because Jefferson understood that the secession of the states of creating the District of Columbia was a very hot issue. He was very well aware of this. And actually, he'd been involved, not just the first time, but he'd been involved several times in his life in speculation of land and speculation of value of land, buying up property so that he could make a financial advantage. Things in those days move slowly, but 9 times out of 10, you know, when all of a sudden your land that was considered Virginia's land now was, you know, a part of Washington, D.C., it would have brought the value up of that land. And that really was what ended up happening. As Jefferson sealed this deal, the first thing he did was he went out and purchased land. At least, I think that was his design. I don't have evidence that what land he purchased or what he did, but there is no doubt, because he did later on expose this to Madison that, you know, hey, this is a big advantage. So let's continue on, because he's talking about this meeting with Madison, and this is what he says. They came. In other words, Hamilton and Madison showed up at Jefferson's house. I opened the subject to them, acknowledged that my situation had not permitted me to understand it sufficiently, but encouraged them to consider the thing together. They did so. It intended in Madison's acquiescence in a proposition that the question could be again brought before the House by a way of amendment from the Senate, that though he would not vote for it, nor entirely withdraw his opposition, yet he would not be strenuous, but leave it to its fate. And so that right there, my friends, is, I believe, the cause of Madison's rolling in the grave. Because out of all of the things he did, this was the one thing that bit him in the butt, and he was stuck with it as the president, because as he became president, and he was actually the Secretary of State when they had to recreate the Second National Bank. And Madison, when he became president, he didn't shut it down, because at that point he saw, and, you know, he too was basically caught in this, well, we've been doing this, I don't want to look like the bad guy by shutting this down. So, anyway, so we're really seeing, you know, how these men made mistakes. We all make mistakes. Sometimes we, you know, do it directly. Sometimes we do it indirectly. And sometimes we get persuaded not knowing the consequences of what we have been convinced to do. So anyway, with that, we'll be right back after this break.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved and supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contributions page, and you can become a listed supporter of liberty. Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so, well, again, this is Jefferson recounting how this compromise came to be, right? And so this is what he says now. This is what he says next. It was observed, I forget by which of them, that as the pill would be bitter one to the southern states, something should be done to soothe them, that the removal of the seat of government to the Potomac was a just measure and would probably be a popular one with them, and would be a proper one to follow the assumption. It was agreed to speak to Mr. White and Mr. Lee, whose districts lay on the Potomac. Now, in those days, they spelt it Patow, it's P-A-T-O-W, Mac, M-A-C. Anyway, and to refer to them to consider how far the interest of their particular districts might be sufficient inducement to them to yield to the assumption. This was done. Mr. Lee came into it without hesitation. Mr. White had some qualms, but finally agreed. The measure came down by way of amendment from the Senate and was carried by the change of White and Lee's votes. But the removal to the Potomac could not be carried unless Pennsylvania could be engaged in it. This Hamilton took on himself, and chiefly, as I understood, through the agency of Robert Morris, obtained the vote of that state on agreeing to an intermediate residence at Philadelphia. In other words, where was Congress at this point in time? It was up in New York. And so this is the reason why it shifted from New York back to Philadelphia before it shifted to the District of Columbia. So if I remember correctly, I believe Thomas Jefferson was the first occupant of the White House. So it took a few years, because we're talking 1790, and Jefferson didn't take the, you know, didn't obtain the presidency until 1800. So the official building of the White House wasn't done until 1800 or later, I guess. And, you know, it took a while to get the House of Congress. So in other words, they were working and functioning in Philadelphia for a good decade. So this was the bone that they threw to Pennsylvania. This is the real history of the assumption, about which many erroneous conjectures have been published. It was unjust in itself, oppressive to the states, and was acquiesced in merely from a fear of disunion while our government was still in it, its most infant state. It enabled Hamilton so to strengthen himself by corrupt services to many that he could afterwards carry his bank scheme and every measure he proposed in defiance of all opposition. In fact, it was principal guard. So, what I'm doing, if you didn't know, I highlight as I read this stuff because this is just gold. And every measure he proposed in defiance of all opposition, and in fact, it was a principal ground whereon was reared up that speculating phalanx in and out of Congress was and has been able to give laws and changing the political complexion of the government of the United States. And so there's more, and actually you can find this in the Founders' Archives, Thomas Jefferson's the recollection of what the compromise really did. But you can tell that when he actually wrote this, it wasn't in 1790. It was a couple of years later when he actually saw the other dominoes lay down or knocked down, where, boom, the bank. And he literally points to the fact that now Madison is trying to create a bank. So, and I hope you appreciate the fact that I'm doing this backwards, that I'm starting with the end, and then I'm going through how this all unraveled. Because, folks, when you look at what the heck has happened, you know, when did the states actually grant themselves? Because let's look at this in modern time. Go and find how many times the states had established emergency rules for, you know, to basically shut down and usurp power. All of this is unconstitutional, but when did they start doing that? And you'll probably find that in the last 10, if not 20 years, in the last two decades, almost every state's Emergency Powers Act was established. Do you think that that's a coincidence that all of a sudden they started doing this? Do you think that as we were starting to be warned and we started to get programmed about, you know, bad viruses and this, you know, pandemics and all of these types of things that may have actually helped lay the groundwork that, you know, gave them the justification of doing these things? Absolutely. It's all about corruption. And that therein lies the truth of what we have. So now, I think I've got enough time to actually read through, and this is going to be really difficult for me, because this is actually out of the records of, this isn't actually an extract, it's an extract from the Annals of Congress. So what they did, if you go through the Annals of Congress, that's actually the debates in the House. And in the, I don't think actually in the Annals of Congress you get the debates of the Senate. In the Congressional Globe you do. Because the Senate kind of maintained secrecy with what they conducted because, you know, some of the stuff that they talked about was regarding treaties, national security, that type of stuff. Remember, there were distinctively different roles and responsibilities given to the Senate as given to the House. And it's the same thing in your state. There were clearly distinctive roles that were changed, but when the overreach of the legislative arm, or not legislative, actually it was the judicial arm in Baker v. Carr and Reynolds v. Sims in the 1960s, this is where they dismantled your Republican form of government and took away the suffrage of your counties in your state Senate. These types of words are very important. They're critical words. Understanding suffrage. Who is to be represented and how these senators are to vote. They're to vote in accordance to those people that they're supposed to support. When you take away the association of who they represent, now you open them up to corruption. Now they can actually do what they want to do, and then they can start inflicting all sorts of pain. This is why your counties matter most. I can't emphasize this enough. I really need to finish that article to get back into this, but just suffice it to say, folks, your counties do matter most. Okay, so the Assumption Act, this is the initial bill that started it all. And, excuse me, this is August 4th, 1790. Now, if I remember correctly, I believe that meeting with Jefferson and Madison was somewhere around February of 1790. So it took, what, 6 months, 7 months maybe? Actually, it's 6 or 5 months, something like that. It may have been March. Anyway, this is Chapter 34, an act provision for the payment of the debt of the United States. Whereas justice and the support of public credit require that provision should be made for fulfilling the engagements of the United States in respect to their foreign debt and for funding their domestic debt upon equitable and satisfactory terms. Section 1. Be it enacted by the Senate and the House of Representatives of the United States of America in Congress assembled, that reserving out of the monies which have arisen since the last day of December last past, and which shall hereafter arise from the duties on goods, wares, and merchandise imported into the United States, and on the tonnage of ships or vessels, the yearly sum of $600,000 or so much thereof as may be apportioned from time to time towards the support of the government of the United States and their common defense. The residue of said monies or so much thereof as may be necessary, as the same shall be received in each year next after the sum reserved as aforesaid, shall be and is hereby appropriated to the payment of the interest which shall from time to time become due on the loans heretofore made by the United States in foreign countries, and also to the payment of interest on such further loans as may be obtained for discharging the arrears of interest thereupon, and the whole or any part of the principal thereof, to continue so appropriated until the said loans, as well as those already made, as those which shall be made in virtue of this act, shall be fully satisfied pursuant to the contracts relating to the same and to the law and contrary notwithstanding, and provided that nothing herein contained shall be construed to annul or alter any appropriation made by law prior to the passing of this act. And as new loans are and will be necessary for the payment of the aforesaid arrears of interest and the installments of the principal of the said foreign debt due and growing due, and may be found expedient for effecting an entire alteration in the state of the same. Second, Section 2. Be it further enacted that the President of the United States be, and he is hereby authorized to cause to be borrowed on behalf of the United States a sum or sums not exceeding in the whole $12 million, and that so much of the sum as may be necessary to discharge of the said arrears and installments, and if it can be effected upon terms advantageous to the United States, to the paying off the whole of the said foreign debt, but are be appropriated solely to those purposes, and that the President is moreover further authorized to cause to be made such other contracts respecting the said debt as shall be found for the interest of the said states, provided nevertheless that no engagement nor contract shall be entered into which shall preclude the United States from reimbursing any sums or sums borrowed within 15 years after the same shall have been lent or advanced. And whereas it is desirable to adapt the nature of the provision to be made for the domestic debt to the present circumstances of the United States, as far as it shall be found practical and consistently with good faith and the rights of the creditors, which shall be done by a voluntary loan on their part. Section 3. Be it therefore further acted that a loan to the full amount of the said domestic debt be, and the same is hereby proposed, and the books for receiving subscriptions to the said loan be opened at the Treasury of the United States and by a commissioner to be appointed in each of the states on the first day of October next, to continue open until the last day of September. So in other words, that was the beginning of the fiscal year. So the government actually, instead of going on a calendar year, they created their fiscal year from October to September. Okay? and that the sums which shall be subscribed thereto be payable in certificates issued for the said debt according to their specie value and computing the interest upon such as bear interest to the last day of December next inclusively, which said certificates shall be of these several descriptions, to wit, those issued by the Registry of the Treasury, those issued by the commissioners of the loans in the several states, including certificates given pursuant to the Act of Congress of the 2nd of January, 1779, for bills of credit of the several emissions of the 20th of May, 1777, and the 11th of April, 1778. Those issued by the commissioners for the adjustment for the accounts to the quartermaster, commissary, hospital, clothing, and marine departments. Now, see, interestingly, they didn't say the Department of the Navy. They said the marine departments. Anyway, those issued by the commissioner for the adjustment of accounts in their respective states. Those issued by the late and present paymaster general or commissioner of army accounts. Those issued for the payment of interest, commonly called indents of interest, and in the bills of credit issued by the authority of the United States in Congress, assembled at the rate of $100 in the said bills for $1 in specie. Now, let me take a little break here. They're already talking about, because they have not had the Treasury Act, that doesn't come until 1792. So in other words, the federal government actually starts printing dollars, starts printing a specie that they're going to start emitting. And this specie is the way they actually, you know, I'll just say, overcome the state's paper money. And then eventually they move everything to gold and silver coin. And I believe they still played with dollar bills intermittently after the 1792 Treasury Act. And it be further enacted that for the whole or any part of any sum subscribed to the said loan by any person or persons or body politic, which shall be paid in the principal of the said domestic debt, the subscriber or subscribers shall be entitled to a certificate purporting that the United States owe to the holder or holders thereof his, her, or there assigns a sum to be expressed therein equal to 2/3 of the sum so paid, bearing an interest of 6% per annum, payable quarterly, and subject to redemption by payments not exceeding in 1 year on an account, but both of principal and interest. The proportion of $8 upon 100 of the sum mentioned in such certificate, and to add certificate purporting to, and basically this is very similar to the U.S. savings bonds, right? That the United States owe to the holders or the holders thereof, his, her, or their assigns a sum to express therein equal to the proportion of the $33.33 upon 100 of the sum so paid, which after the year 1,800 shall bear, 1,800, in other words, the year 1800, bear an interest of 6% per annum, payable quarterly, yearly, and subject to the redemption by payments not exceeding in 1 year on account both of the principal and interest in the proportion of $80 upon 100 of the sum mentioned in such certificate, provided that it shall not be understood that the United States shall be bound or obliged to redeem in the proportion aforesaid, but it shall be understood only that they have a right so to do. Now, in other words, this is kind of how they basically get the funding, because they actually get people to get these certificates, buy these certificates. And it be further enacted that the whole or any part of any sum subscribed to the said loan by any person or persons or body politic, which shall be paid in the interest of said domestic debt computed to the said last day of December next, or in the said certificates issued in payment of interest, commonly called indents of interest, the subscriber or subscribers shall be entitled to a certificate purporting that the United States owe to the holder or holders thereof his, her, or their assigns a sum to be specified therein equal to that by him, her, or them so paid, bearing an interest of 3% per annum, payable quarterly, yearly, and subject to redemption by payment of the sum specified therein whenever provision shall be made by law for that purpose. So now we're into Section 6. This goes on a ways, and I'm just, you know, I've got several more pages to do. We're about halfway through this. This is a total of 22 pages. I've got page 4 done. And so, Section 6, and be it further enacted that a commissioner be appointed for each state to reside therein, whose duty it shall be to superintend the subscriptions to the said loan. In other words, these are basically your loan sharks. These are the guys that actually have these certificates to kind of hand out that people pay based on a lesser value of the face value that they end up getting the total face value when they redeem these. Now, if you remember what I basically said, everything that they're doing here, and they're basically laying it out, that this, when does this come to fruition? When do these certificates come out to be paid off? The year 1800. Now, didn't I tell you that it was during Jefferson's term when all of a sudden they had to start paying? So not everybody rushed down to the Treasury or rushed down to these commissioners and say, okay, give me my money. Because when they actually had to pay the money out, they had to pay the money out with gold and silver. Because that's what the Treasury Act did in 1792 and started creating that. But guess what happened? They didn't have enough. In other words, they put wind in their sails, but they just didn't have enough to pay America. So what ended up happening was, as I told you in the previous, yesterday's show, that's when this bank and this scheme basically fell flat on its face. Now, I'm not sure if Hamilton had been killed yet by the duel, but I believe that this was when everything started unraveling on Hamilton. And so this was probably a good cause, because this is when, you know, Hamilton was slinging insults at Aaron Burr, another lawyer up in New York, and Aaron Burr didn't take kindly to it. And Monroe was there to try to, you know, convince him not to move further with, you know, and to, you know, calm down, and Burr would have none of it. I think I mentioned before that Burr was the guy that kept Monroe from actually going and dueling with Hamilton as well. Had Burr actually allowed Monroe to duel with Hamilton, one, it wouldn't have been on his head, and it would have changed Monroe and the perception of Monroe in America that he may not have been the next president after Madison. I mean, there are a lot of ramifications had the events been changed by that one turn of events with Aaron Burr convincing Monroe not to pursue the duel. Does that make sense? I think it does. I think that's pretty clear. So it's kind of interesting how everything was really coming, and the whole scheme that Hamilton created, that he sold everybody on. I mean, Adams was really leveraged in this bank. He went bankrupt. Now, one of the things that's important, and I don't have time in the curriculum, but maybe I should add this, and we'll talk about this in maybe a future show or what have you. But one of the things that you'll find is they actually had debtor's prison. They actually had debtor's prison back then, and they talked about sending people that were in debt to the government to debtor's prison. Anyway, Section 6. And it be it further enacted that a commissioner be appointed for each state to reside therein, there to liquidate the specie value, such of them as shall not be been before liquidated, to issue certificates above mentioned in lieu thereof according to the terms of each subscription, to enter in books to be by him kept for that purpose credits to the respective subscriber to the said loan for the sums to which they shall be respectively entitled, to transfer the said credits upon the said books from time to time as shall be requisite to pay the interest thereupon, as the same shall become due, and generally to observe and perform such direction and regulations as shall be prescribed to him by the Secretary of the Treasury touching the execution of his office. And it shall be further enacted that the only stock which shall be created pursuant to this act shall be transferably only on the books of the Treasury or of the said commissioners respectively, upon which the credit for the same shall exist at the time or of transfer by the proprietor or proprietors of such stock, his, her, or their attorney. But it shall be lawful for the Secretary of Treasury by special warrant under his hand and the seal of the Treasury, countersigned by the comptroller and registered by the register at the request of the respective proprietors, to authorize the transfer of such stock from the books of one commissioner to those of another, or to those of the Treasury and from those of the Treasury to those of a commissioner. In other words, they were going to be, you know, kind of duplicating and moving these things around. But bottom line, this was almost like a Ponzi scheme. They got everybody to throw money in, and then they were going to pay them interest on this regular payment cycle. And so they would be holding 80% of the face value and then slowly giving them their 20% back. But by the year 1800, the rest was due. In other words, that 80% that they actually received, that's when the rest was due. They were only paying interest on this. And there's no doubt in my mind, folks, anybody of a sound mind would have saw anybody looking at what was going in and what was coming out of the Treasury, that by 1800, they were in trouble, before 1800. And so in 1798, this is when they actually made it illegal. They passed a law that you could not say disparaging remarks in 1798, because I'll bet you anything, this was one of those things to create a stopgap to say when all of a sudden the bank defaults, it's going to be bad. But because the occupants and the scoundrels that were involved in all of this were no longer in office because of the 1800 election, I think it kind of took some of the wind out of the sail. But I'll tell you, it didn't take the sting out of these people losing their money. And so, more importantly, those who literally were planning on getting their money back, like John Adams. And so he basically died a pauper. I shouldn't say that. But he did have a hard... I don't think he ever truly financially recovered from what he ended up doing. But he did make a king's ransom on selling his books to the library after the War of 1812, to the Congressional Library. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're going through all of this so that you understand how important these things are. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Moby Strip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Mobius Strip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.